This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
It was the time of the preacher, when the story began, of the choice of a lady and the love of a man.
Oh yeah.
How he loved her.
Nothing
so
like a little,
dearly.
Little slick Willie Nelson to start a podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Welcome. Welcome once again to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. Along with me again, as always, is my cohort, my partner in crime.
Your hetero Nick, life mate, if you will.
Indeed. Nick Duke. Nick, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. And just as a forewarning before we ever start this podcast, if the term Slick Willy is even borderline offensive to you, turn off the podcast now because it's only going to get worse from here. I feel the need to say up front, this is by far and away, by a country mile, the most not safe for work, public, family, or possibly even private consumption podcast we've ever done, mainly because the primary topic of conversation today is our love for the comic series Preacher and our top five Preacher characters, as well as a little taste of our thoughts on the recent Preacher pilot. So if you're offended by much of anything, I would recommend just not even listening to this podcast. Turn it off. Turn it off right now. Go do something productive with your time.
Yes, something that doesn't involve listening to grown men talk about comic books. And
comic books that happen to have bestiality in them. There you go. There's an indication. If you're still listening after bestiality, you're committed now. Either you got to leave now or you got to stay till the end. That's how it works.
That's right. And don't you dare, no matter what you do, start chanting "You can't podcast" at us.
Or start chanting "You still suck."
No, don't do that. Don't do that either.
Which we probably do still suck. I mean,
we probably do, but you don't have to chant it at us. That's just mean. And also, we can't hear you. I'd remind you that that's not how podcasts work. We're not in a live environment here, you know?
Exactly.
So, but yeah, no, in all seriousness, ladies and gentlemen, this is not going to be indicative of our usual material. I think typically our podcasts are pretty safe for the whole family, for the most part. I mean, you know, given depending on the subject material,
we drop the occasional curse in there, but we try to limit it.
We try to be family friendly.
It's kind of like a PG-13 movie. You get about one F-bomb to use, and we'll usually use it. But this one is going to be rated hard R, borderline NC-17 at times. So
yeah, this is we try to keep it family friendly, but this is one that there's no way that you can really delve into the Preacher comic book and remain family friendly. There's really no other way about it. So again, warning ahead of time, if you've got any sensitivity issues, if you're turned off by language or certain sexual references and things like that.
If you find any form of sexual deviancy, any religious satire, or the idea of mass murder offensive to you in any way, any of those three things, like I said, probably best just go ahead and turn it off now.
Yeah, and David, we're glad you're still listening. So, thanks for that.
We won't tell your mom, I promise.
Yep. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Countdown. It's proven to be one of our most popular, our most popular columns back in the day that we were doing the last couple of years, where we take our five favorite or least favorite things in a different category related to comics and count them down. Pretty obvious, pretty straightforward.
It's a countdown.
That's right. And in this case, we're counting down our top five favorite characters from the Garth Ennis, Steve Dillon classic series known as Preacher. And as a caveat to this, we are excluding the lead character, Jesse Custer, and we're only counting other characters, outside characters beyond Jesse, who is the center point character of the story. for comparison, he would be the, for those who haven't read Preacher, he would be like the Rick Grimes, I suppose, of the Preacher.
It would be like doing a countdown of our favorite Batman characters and putting Bruce Wayne on the list. Like, it just...
Right, yeah. It's,
kinda,
it's just
it's
thought,
obvious,
yeah.
obvious to such a degree that you kind of want to, you know, go move past that, so...
Yes. So, with that being said, we're going to kick it off with our usual segment. What you reading? What you watching? Hey, what you reading and watching?
That wasn't Bee Gees-esque at all, which is what I thought you were going for.
No, I'm trying out a lot of different things. David has offered his services. David Sunday has offered his services to
his
do a jingle for
His services aren't that
it.
Good. I've had them. And, you know, he uses too much teeth for me, personally.
That's neither here nor there. I found David to be both gentle and loving in our previous encounters. But all that being said, we are still waiting on a jingle. David, Russell, Todd, any of you out there in Podcastville that are willing to submit us to a jingle, we're willing to listen. We're not going to guarantee usage, but we're willing to try things out and see how they stick. You know, I haven't really sat down and started trying to come up with a jingle myself, but we need one for this segment where we talk to you about the things that we're reading and watching in a given week.
And we all know that Todd could probably record an old-timey swing record to dance to with your favorite dame, so it'd be good.
Dame Judi Dench, perhaps.
Ooh. As we all know, Dame Helen Mirren could get it daily, but that's another topic for another day.
Yes, your fascination with Helen Mirren knows no bounds.
Actually, my fascination with Big E's fascination with Helen Mirren knows no bounds. But again...
I stand by the original statement. But moving along, we're going to start out with what we're reading because what we're watching is going to focus heavily on the recent television premiere of Preacher. So let's get started with what we're reading. Nick, what have you been reading in the last week?
I think you and I kind of had some similar experiences in that after doing last week's Civil War podcast, we both kind of wanted to delve a little bit into those tie-ins I referenced so heavily. And so I think you actually probably made more progress than I did on that front. I pulled out a couple issues of Fantastic Four that tied in and read a few of those. Written by J. Michael Straczynski. I can't remember who the artist on them was. And I had forgotten how good those were because I'm used to terrible, awful, boring Fantastic Four books that even like decent Fantastic Four books seem amazing in comparison. And these were some pretty good Fantastic Four books, I got to say. Also pulled out that New Avengers Illuminati Road to Civil War one-shot that kind of gave you most of the backstory coming into Civil War that really should have been in the main title, as we discussed last week. So I read those. Won't spend too much time on those because they've been out there for years, people. If you want to read them, I would recommend them. There was nothing that I revisited that was bad.
I have to ask, what exactly delineates a good Fantastic Four story? Because I don't think I've ever read one that I would consider to be good.
Finding a way to write these characters as if they are real modern human beings and not set anachronisms from the 60s and 70s would be the best way I could put it. Straczynski's got a way with dialogue that makes Johnny Storm Storm brings the humor, you know, he and the Thing, his interplay, and he doesn't write his Reed Richards as such a pompous, detached ass, and he writes a Sue that's a fiercely independent woman, but also very loving and nurturing towards her family. So it's got the family dynamic updated for a modern setting is the best way I can put it, because the family dynamic does work. It's just they haven't really found a way to make it work with those characters in recent years, in my opinion.
Right, I agree.
So that's what I read, you know, from my old back issue log. Only, you know, I picked up 5 books at the shop last week. As I talked about last week, I was caught up briefly, and that only took a week to undo. I only got through 3 of my 5 issues this week, but I'll run through them real quick. One of those was Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino's Old Man Logan, which continues to be just a great read, especially for the Sorrentino art. I think we've been over many times how much we love his art style and how much appreciation we have for his work. It's just, it continues to be the best work in comics from an art perspective, in my opinion. And actually, I was going to ask you, this issue of Old Man Logan introduces a set of characters I've never heard of them before, so you have a little bit more X-Men knowledge than I do. Are you familiar with characters called the Reavers?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I don't know who they are. They're the main villains of this issue, so I...
Yeah. The Reavers are... I mean, Tim and Todd would have much more detailed memories and explanations of them than I, because I was out of X-Men for so long. But yeah, the Reavers were major X-Men characters back in the 80s, actually. And if you remember from the cartoon, they were actually affiliated with Lady Deathstrike on the cartoon.
I do remember that now.
So they're longtime foes of Logan, at least in that medium. And in the comics, I believe they were involved in the and Tim's going to kill me if I get this wrong, but I think they were involved in the Fall of the Mutants storyline. I could be wrong about that, but they were a pretty big deal. Sabretooth has had connections with them over the years, so yeah, they're a long-standing part.
Have they always been organics that are intertwined with machines, or is that
yes? Absolutely. If you look back in the 80s, they all kind of like they look. It's almost like cyborg versions of like Stephen Hawking. It's like a way that I would describe like
a dude. In this Old Man Logan book, there's a guy who's a guy from the torso up and then a tank from the waist down. So I guess that.
Yep.
Okay.
That's exactly their gimmick. Yep.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah. So I read that. Like I said, great issue. Not so good. And I was really disappointed by this. I read Civil War II, number 0, which is almost like Rambo 2 First Blood, but that's another topic for another day. They did something I was afraid they were doing in the first place. Their publishing schedule was very strange because on the last couple shows, we've discussed the Free Comic Book Day Civil War II issue, and the Free Comic Book Day Civil War issue takes place after Civil War II-0, but came out before it. So I read the story in inverse order almost thus far. That character, that inhuman character of Ulysses, who is heavily featured in the Free Comic Book Day issue, this is actually his origin story. I was under the impression he was a pre-existing Inhuman character, but no, they show you his origin here.
Too.
And for a book that's supposed to be about Tony Stark, ain't no Tony Stark in this book. I mean, there is a vague reference made to him at one point when in one of the book's most bizarre scenes, the Marvel version of Barack Obama compares Tony Stark to Donald Trump. But that's it. Tony Stark never appears. And on the front of that scene, I got to mention that one of the more bizarre scenes I've ever read in comics, where the Marvel Universe version of Barack Obama has a top secret meeting with James Rhodes to offer him not only the Secretary of Defense job, but he also offers to use his political influence to make James Rhodes the next face of the Democratic Party and, by proxy, the next president of the United States. His reasoning: one of you superhero types is going to run for president eventually anyway. Might as well be you instead of some rich guy who's going to try and buy his way to the presidency like Tony Stark. I don't know what else to say about that.
I don't really know either. I don't know. Hopefully the main series will be a little better, but I that does not fill me with hope. What appears to be the crux of the dispute between what appears to be
there is
the
none
moral
to this
center
point.
Of Civil War II?
There is none to this point. The best I can gather from it is you get a couple of framing sequences with She-Hulk in the courtroom arguing a case of a former supervillain who I can't remember which supervillain it was at this point, who had been overheard discussing his previous supervillain life. He was reformed, and the cops brought him in because they thought, you know, that it was a sign he was about to fall off the wagon, so to speak, and he was about to hurt some people. And they actually prosecute him, even though he doesn't do anything. And Jen Walters argues in his defense and loses the case. And so I think that's intended to set up that central theme of preemptive action versus, you know, kind of the Minority Report story is what I think they're going for.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, what's the appropriate level of preemptive action?
Oh, I got you. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So, really, honestly, the She-Hulk stuff, and I've never really cared about She-Hulk's character before. That was the only good stuff in the book, for the most part, were her scenes. So, I'm still on board for the book. I'm going to give it a shot, but the next issue really needs to win me over in a big bad way and give me a reason to care about a conflict between these characters and give these characters a reason to have a conflict with each other. To this point, they have not. So, but moving on from that, the last book I read this week, and I'm going to propose that we just rename my portion of this segment to the Aqua Minute, because once again, Dan Abnett's Aquaman, absolutely an amazing issue. The final issue of the pre-rebirth series, issue 52 of Aquaman, where Arthur has his climactic confrontation with both the Scavenger and a new villain called Deadwater. I can't say enough great things about it. Mira, again, gets a chance to shine. The art is very, very good. And I am beyond psyched for Rebirth. And they kind of set up what I think is going to be the Rebirth, the initial storyline of Arthur discovering that there are things in the ocean that even he is unaware of. And he and Mira setting off to almost go on like a Star Trek-like journey across the oceans to explore new territory and make sure that those threats don't endanger either Atlantis or the surface world. So,
very cool.
Can't wait for that Rebirth issue coming in a couple weeks. It's high on my list of titles post-Rebirth that I'm looking forward to reading, if not at the top, honestly.
Yeah, that all sounds really good. I'm highly interested in it, and the only thing that I hope is that they find an artist that can draw Aquaman the way that Namor was drawn in Civil War, with the crotch protruded out.
With a grapefruit-sized penis.
We're getting you a little warmed up for the preacher discussion, folks.
Yes.
But on my end, I've actually done quite a bit of reading in the last week. As Nick alluded to a moment ago, I did go back and read the thanks to the wonderful, fantastic Marvel Unlimited app.
Which, if you can, you should read on your iPad Pro.
And you can download songs to listen to on your iPad Pro through the iTunes Store as well.
Yep.
And there's also an Amazon link on placetobenation.com. We can just advertise for the rest of this segment. But I will say that I went back to read the one of the early amazing Spider-Man tie-ins to Civil War. It's actually a prelude to Civil War in which Spider-Man receives his new yellow and red suit from Tony Stark. And this is written by J. Michael Straczynski. And it was really good. Like, it was better than any of the Civil War issues I read, to be honest with you. And also, it was better than any Spider-Man comic I've read in forever. And it made me really want to go back and read more of Straczynski's Spider-Man run, because in the first three pages, it's a great Spider-Man. It's a great Mary Jane Watson who has a personality, which so many writers, even when I was a kid, struggled with, was writing Mary Jane with an actual personality instead of just a cardboard cutout figure. It's a great Mary Jane, and it's a funny Tony Stark. We spent a big portion of last week talking about how boring Tony Stark was back then. Not when written by JMS, because his interaction with Peter and MJ is phenomenal. Like, for instance, his voice comes through this, like, random, like, owl thing that's sitting in Peter's room while him and MJ are asleep, and it's Tony's voice through the other side, and MJ gets up, you know, barely wearing anything, and walks to it, and she goes, "Please tell me that you can't see through this thing." And Tony's like, "Well, nice tan lines." And, of course, she storms off angry, and he goes, "It was a joke! I swear it was a joke!" So just really good interaction between all these characters there.
It really is unfortunate on so many levels what happened with One More Day, because regardless of how you feel about the creative aspect of it, the actual storyline itself, it led to a pretty bitter divorce between J. Michael Straczynski and Marvel. And that dude, his stuff from that era, that pre and right after Civil War era, only gets better with time. His Thor run, as I told you before, is one of my favorite Thor runs of all time. Those Fantastic Four issues I just read are great. His Spider-Man, with the exception of the other, which you can, you know, people have conflicting opinions on, to say the least, but the majority of his Spider-Man run is just amazing stuff. And that was really bad. That's one of the bad things about One More Day, is that they almost exclusively eliminated just his run. You know, he had had such a long run on the character that it was kind of really petty what they did to him, in a way, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion.
Quite frankly, from under the black resist all hat, ladies and gentlemen. Now, and moving on to more current things, I actually have been working my way through my backlog of Batman and Justice League issues. I'm finally all caught up on Batman. I have finished off the new 52 Batman. I read issue number 51. Which was the finale for Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, and I finished issue 52, which was kind of a fill-in issue by James Tynion. however you pronounce his name, the fourth is his the last part of his name there, the suffix. And I finished that off, and pretty good stuff. I'll be completely honest, and this is going to surprise a lot of people. I think I actually liked his fill-in issue better than I liked issue 51.
Oh, I don't agree with that, but
I know that's very controversial. I liked 51 okay, but I think I was a little underwhelmed because of the high expectations I have for Snyder and Capullo Batman. It was still good. And you know, it was a nice issue, a nice, you know, cooling down issue. But what I really liked the Tynion Batman. It surprised me because I'm typically not a big fan of his writing. But he wrote a good Bruce, and he touched an emotional core between Bruce and Alfred that really worked for me. The only thing that didn't work in the issue, and I can see where this would hold it back, the villain was really, really badly designed. It was the villain whose name is Crypsis is a clear knockoff of the Dragon Ball Z villain Frieza. Completely designed the same way as Frieza. Not a very good design, not a very clever usage.
Honestly,
of the villain. But
the art in that entire issue didn't do much for me. Not that it was bad per se, but just not my my favorite art style on the face of the planet.
I mean, it was no Greg Capullo, certainly. But the emotional crux of the story, I think, worked for me.
I don't want it to sound like I didn't like the issue, because I did as well. I just liked 51 a bit better.
Yeah, and 51 was fine. I didn't have any issues with 51. It was still a good issue. It was probably one of my lesser Snyder and Capullo issues, but it was still good. And I hate to see that. I mean, I hate to see that run come to an end. But yeah, that was very good. And I have the last few days been catching up on Justice League. I finished off issues 47 and 48 in the last 2 days, and wow, it's been exceptionally good.
It has.
The Darkseid War is clearly the best of all of Geoff Johns' Justice League stories since the start of the New 52.
And probably the best. It and the Outsiders War from that Green Arrow arc that we talked about, you know, a few podcasts back, are probably my two favorite non-Snyder Batman stories of the New 52, if we're talking just
yeah.
single story arcs, you know?
Single story arcs, yeah, I would agree. It's every issue takes you on a ride and surprises you and offers thrills. The art is spectacular, and it's amazing because a lot of times I complain if there's a story arc and there are different artists for different issues in the story arc. But in this case, they've gone between Jason Fabok and Francis Manapul, who are two of the best artists in comics. So if you're going to have to trade off, that's a pretty good duo to trade off on. And the art has been spectacular. The story has been genuinely surprising, but not in a shock value way, in an actual, like, wow, I didn't see that coming, and it works kind of way. It's been action-packed. And it feels – we've talked in the past in some of our columns talking about, in particular, the death of Superman. And one of the really good things about that story is how it escalates from the beginning to the end. And I don't know about you, Nick, but I really feel like this story has built almost like you want a continuing story to build, like you want a great wrestling match to build, where it's slow to start and it picks up the pace and it gets faster and faster and faster to the point where it climaxes exactly where it's supposed to.
So what you're saying is that it kind of flows like a Geoff Johns Justice League comic is supposed to flow.
Yes, and we're delving into inside jokes that are so inside that we are the only ones that will get them.
A little inside, I know.
Yes, but no, the sense of escalation is what I've really enjoyed about this story, that I feel right now, I just finished 48, and it just feels like everything is hitting a crescendo, and we've got the Crime Syndicate and the Justice League teaming up to go up against the former Anti-Monitor, Mobius. So it should be a fun ride, and I'm really interested to read 49, which I hope to do tonight, and set up for the big finale, Justice League number 50.
Yeah,
comes
and
out
as
on
a,
Wednesday.
As a little PSA, I mean, hopefully by the time this podcast is up, most of you guys who are really interested in this will have already read DC Universe Rebirth. But if you haven't, and you're also reading Justice League, you're supposed to read Justice League 50 this Wednesday before you read DC Universe Rebirth Zero. It is, they're dropping on the same day. Rebirth is getting all the hype right now, but Justice League 50 is supposed to be highly recommended reading before going into that Rebirth 80-page special. So don't forget that when you make your trip to your shop if you haven't already.
Absolutely. And then just yesterday, I cracked open my absolute edition of Green Lantern Rebirth. And it's a beautiful, oversized version of that story with art and the way that it was originally drawn by Ethan Van Sciver. It's beautiful. It's a great, great collection. One of my favorite collections DC's ever put out, actually. It's mind-blowingly good. And I started reading that again, read the intro from Brad Meltzer, and read some of the additional... there's some additional prelude material that's included in this collection. Their little origin story that Johns and Van Sciver did for Hal is included at the beginning, so that was pretty cool. And that wraps up pretty much what I've been reading. And with that said, we are going to get cracking on what we're watching, which, of course, brings me to the long-awaited. And by long-awaited, I mean about... This has been waited on by people for about 15 years.
We've been talking about this, I mean, various Preacher. Incarnations of it for so long. You know, it. Kevin Smith was attached at one point to do a movie version. Mark Steven Johnson was attached to do an HBO series version. Sam Mendes at one point was attached. There have been so many names and so many incarnations of this project. I even read about one, you know, just today that I had no idea existed, where somebody wanted to do Preacher, but do it completely seriously and remove all the humor from it. That was a pitch that was floating around 2003, apparently. So, can't remember the name of that guy who thought that was a great idea, but, yeah.
Thank God he was not listened to.
Yes, but your point is, it's been a long time coming. And
right. The series started in what, 95, and as early as 98, people have been talking about doing an adaptation of this comic series. And we finally got one off the ground. We finally got one filmed and the pilot ordered and a series ordered. And Sunday night was the premiere of this show. And let's just get right into it. Both of us are huge fans of the book. And we're coming into this, I think, a little bit differently from most.
A little bit jaded, probably.
Yeah, I am extremely open to alternate versions of characters in superhero comics because I think that's the nature of superhero comics. I'm much more protective of the creator-owned stuff, I think.
Well, I mean, superhero comics over the generations have been reinterpreted by a variety of creators. You know, that's part of the medium. Preacher is the vision of one artist and one writer. That's what it's been. It's only been one thing for its entire existence. So it's a little bit different in that regard, I would say.
Right, right. And so we're coming at this...
Kind of like how Watchmen, you know, the only version of Watchmen is the Alan Moore Watchmen. You can't take Watchmen and make it into some other thing because then it's not Watchmen.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. And I think that's why both of us are higher on the Zack Snyder version of Watchmen than a lot of people are, because I think to our mind that was about the right way to go about it. Now,
what we wanted out of it.
None of us expected a direct adaptation of Preacher. That was never realistic.
Not on cable, anyway. I mean, if it had been an HBO show, maybe. But AMC, even though they let people get away with a lot of stuff, I know The Walking Dead is there. If you haven't read Preacher, The Walking Dead...
It makes The Walking Dead look like a children's book.
Yes.
It makes Gandhi look like a child pornographer. I was not expecting a direct adaptation. And frankly, I think it's cool when things aren't direct adaptations sometimes because, you know, it gives you something else to watch for. But
and the producers, you know, Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, Sam Catlin, and even Garth Ennis himself have been doing interviews over the last couple of months, kind of trying to prepare the fan base, I think, for the fact that this isn't a direct adaptation, that you're going to have to be willing to accept – you know, some changes, some movement a little bit, you know, away from a strict adaptation of the source material. But they've promised us all along what's going to remain unchanged is the core of who these characters are and the overall tone and heart of the book. They have promised us that would be intact at the least.
And I think that it's important to preface all this, though, to let people know a lot of the complaints that we make are not going to be relevant to a lot of you out there that may not have read – if you haven't read Preacher – some of the gripes that we have aren't going to matter to you. You're looking at this as a TV show, and is it a good show? And that's exactly how you should approach it.
Right.
And I think that I'll go ahead and get this out of the way as well. Both of us enjoyed the pilot. I think that's fair to say. We both liked it.
Yes. Most of the reaction I've seen to the pilot online has been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, comic review sites giving it, you know, 9s out of 10s, 9.5. Some, I can think a couple even gave it a perfect score. And Greg and I both agree, I think, that there was that the good far outweighed the bad in this episode. And like you said, we liked the episode. I think our issue is we didn't like it as much as everybody else seems to have liked it. And we have, I think we have some concerns going forward is the best way I would put it.
I think that's a good summation of it. Let's start off by talking about the good. I think that overall, the show it was a good episode. It was a good pilot. I think it was the right mix of comedy, action, and drama that I was looking for out of a preacher show. It did a good job, for the most part, of introducing the audience to these new the main characters, which would be Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy. It did a good job of establishing these people and letting the audience know, here's who they are, here's the role they're going to play in our story. So I thought they did a good job of that. The action was very good.
When it was there, yeah. Not much action for a pilot, but that's not really... Preacher is rarely about action. You know, it's when it happens, it's big and it's over the top and it's bombastic, and it definitely draws you in the book, but action is not the primary focus, I think that
would be. Yeah, and I would actually disagree. I think there was more action in this pilot than there are in a lot of them, because I think pilots oftentimes get bogged down in trying to introduce characters, and so they lose all semblance of action. There wasn't a ton here, but I think this was a more action-packed episode than you're probably going to get most weeks, because...
Come to think of it, you did have three fairly major
fight scenes,
action scenes, and that's kind of cool. A parallel I hadn't just thought of is that each of those three fight scenes primarily featured one of our three co-leads, so that was cool.
And all of them were very well shot. I thought the production on the episode was really good.
Yep.
So what were some of the things that you liked in particular?
It really feels... The best thing I can say... I'll leave with the best thing I can say about it. It feels like that they've gotten about as close to the tone of the book as I could have expected for a pilot anyway. I felt like they hit that mix, like you mentioned. And everybody reads Preacher a little differently. Like you mentioned, that perfect mix of drama, action, and humor. And for me, I've always viewed it as almost like a pyramid, if this makes sense, where you have the humor as the base of the pyramid, the foundation upon which the comic is built. Mm-hmm. And then you have the drama right there in the middle, and the action is kind of the tip top. And I felt like, for the most part, they recreated that, and that humor was the primary focus of the book.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think humor is the linchpin of Preacher. It's at the heart of everything. It's an absurd book. It's meant to be an absurd book. But I think that there's also that emotional weight and that seriousness that is also the necessary to keep you invested, because Preacher works because of the characters, first and foremost, more so than the plot, although the plot's very good too. And I think you're right. I think the show did a good job of balancing that, of showing you that this is going to have some heavy themes in it, but every time you think that it's getting bogged down in that, there's going to be arseface,
yes,
or there's going to be, a woman who reveals that she apparently enjoys being scalded with hot oil.
Which is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the sexual deviancy we're probably going to get into over the course of the series, I would imagine.
Absolutely. We'll talk about some of the other things probably in our things that we didn't like, but I loved Cassidy.
Yes.
I thought of all the casting choices, that was the one casting choice I have zero complaints about.
None.
That guy was phenomenal. It was right off the page. It was perfect for Cassidy. The fight scene on the airplane was incredible.
That's my favorite fight scene of the pilot.
he jumped off the airplane, just the shot of him laying there with his guts just everywhere, that is so Cassidy and that's so Preacher.
Right.
His conversation with Jesse in the jail cell, phenomenal. Right. Can't say enough about it.
Even the first time they interact and Jesse goes, boy, I can't understand one word you're saying or something to that effect. Man, that was great. The moment I go back to it's so Preacher, for lack of a better term, is the champagne bottle to the gut on the airplane. And then he pops the cork and pours himself a nice little bottle of blood as he prepares for his descent off of the plane.
Oh man, yeah.
And then the hilarious moment with the cow right after that. Also, really, really good. Everything they did with Cassie, like you said, was great. And that's important because, as we'll discuss in a little bit, you know, Cassie is is a character from Preacher that's very near and dear to my heart. So good to see they got him right. Overall, even though I have some issues with the accent and I think it took a little while to really get the character warmed up, so to speak, overall, I think I like Dominic Cooper's Jesse. There are some issues with it. But we'll discuss those in a little bit. Also, mostly enjoyed Arseface. Again, we'll discuss some of my nitpicky things with him as well, but
yeah, the scene in Arseface's bedroom was actually my favorite scene of the episode. It really hit me emotionally in a way that I wasn't expecting. I really enjoyed that. I thought the actor who portrays Arseface, I don't know his name, but he...
That's Ian Coletti.
He's not going to get a ton of credit because of the nature of the character that he's playing. He was awesome in that scene. With his eyes, his mannerisms, the way that he looked down, the way that he delivered, just... I felt for him. I really felt for him. And just really good acting. Really good directing.
And that scene perfectly foreshadows what in theory anyway, if they follow the comic, will be the overarching plot of the show from season to season, in that, you know, Arseface directly mentions that when he used to pray, God used to answer back, and he hasn't heard any answers in a while. So without coming out and saying right out of the gate that God has abdicated the throne, so to speak, that is the implication that is there for fans of the comic.
Yeah.
So.
Now, we mentioned there were a lot of things we liked, and there were more things we liked than things that we didn't like. However, there were some things we didn't like.
I don't even remember his name, but the annoying parishioner who kept following Jesse around 24/7.
Yes. I totally forgot to mention that. Absolutely.
And that subplot winds up beautifully, because that guy winds up being, and obviously at this point, if you haven't realized it by now, we're heavy into spoiler territory, but... So the way it works in the comics and how it appears to work in the show is that Jesse is imbued with the power of the voice of God, in that when he uses that voice, whoever he is using it on is compelled to obey him in the most literal and oftentimes brutal sense.
Yes.
So this character has been complaining to Jesse about his issues with his mother over the course of the entire pilot. And finally, Jesse, when he uses the word on him, says, what is it? Be brave, tell her the truth, open your heart. And you see the character in a montage immediately leave Anvil, go to the airport, fly to Florida, repeating those words over and over again. Be brave, tell her the truth, open your heart. Drive to his mom's nursing home in Florida, surprise her, sit down, tell her how he feels about her, and then when it gets time for the open your heart part, he pulls out a massive hunting knife, cuts his own heart out right in front of her, and then splays it open for her to see. Black humor at its finest, in my opinion. That was a fantastic scene that probably more so than any other scene in the pilot captured the tone and the essence of what Preacher is at its best, in my
Agreed.
Opinion.
Agreed.
Which
and
sounds so weird to say. Like, I'm sure you're praising a show for literally having a son cut his own heart out in front of his mother.
But it sets up also the crux of Jesse's problem, which is Jesse's in over his head. He doesn't know that he's got this in him, and he doesn't know the effect that it has on others yet. So it's going to – that's part of the plot of Preacher, basically, is Jesse coming to terms with and then deciding how to use this bizarre gift/curse that he's been hit with.
Right. I agree with that.
Now, things that we did not enjoy – I will actually get us cracking with this and go into – I think this is an issue that people have no matter what region they're in if people use an accent from the region. In our case, Nick and I are
overly critical of Southern accents.
Yes, we're way too hard on people for Southern accents. As you'll know if you ever hear us talk about The Walking Dead, which we like. But I will say this. I think The Walking Dead accents sound downright authentic compared to most of the accents that I heard in this pilot. I will say that the Dominic Cooper as Jesse grew on me over the course of the episode, and I think the last shot of him finally won me over a little bit. But it won me over in spite of his accent, which does not sound to me like an authentic Texas accent. It doesn't sound the way that I always heard. I always heard Jesse Custer talking in the Matthew McConaughey kind of
Texas drawl,
yeah. Much more assured, much more
right,
natural sounding, and Cooper, his accent just sounds more generically Southern, I guess you would say.
And he has that issue at times where he fades in and out of it.
Fades in and out, right? I agree with you. I had a similar problem with Tulip at first.
Oh, yeah.
To be honest
with
you,
her accent's bad. It's really bad.
It did not sound authentic to me, and it takes me, especially compared to Cassidy, who sounded so authentic.
Well, he is Irish, the guy who plays.
Exactly, and that, so. And it almost begs the question of why AMC seems to cast almost exclusively British actors to play Southern people. There can't be a shortage of Southern actors out there, but not that, again, Andrew Lincoln and all the people on Walking Dead, they do a really good job, but it's just a question that I have to ask. But all that being said, the accents were a bit of a barrier for me at first.
And see, I would agree with that, especially in the cases of Jesse and Tulip, but I thought actually the even more ancillary characters outside of those, because you have the core three of Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy, but I thought the other characters in the show, I thought their accents for the most part were fine.
No, I agree with you. I agree. I didn't have any issue with anybody else, really. It was mainly Jesse and Tula, but they were two-thirds of the three main characters in the show. So,
if we're going to get nitpicky about voices, one of our long-running gags among our friends is Arseface voice, as we'll talk about in a little bit in the countdown portion. And the gimmick, essentially, is that Arseface speaks almost exclusively in noises that nobody can really understand, to the point where the book actually has to subtitle everything he says. The show subtitles everything Arseface says in this one. My problem with it was I could understand him almost perfectly clearly. And that's a small, tiny, nerdy, nitpicky thing that bothered me, and I can't help it.
Yeah, that I agree. That was an issue as well.
Did you see his teeth directly behind?
Yep.
Yeah.
I didn't see it. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't see it. I watched the show on delay. I DVR'd it and watched it the next morning and the next afternoon, split it up. And a friend of mine actually pointed that out on Facebook, and I did notice it. I did notice it in the scene that you could see his teeth underneath. And, you know, part of Arseface's gimmick is he doesn't have teeth. So, that was a little minor mix-up, a rare production flaw on their end. And I agree that Arseface, we've waited so long to hear the voice, to hear his unique language, that it was a bit of a disappointment that he was so relatively easy to understand. It didn't bother me, I think, as much as it bothered you, but it would have been nice to hear him talk more like we've always talked.
And not a single shutha was had.
No shutha. My only hope is that I hope at some point he gets another unfortunate accident that makes his voice less legible.
Even worse.
Yes.
Interesting take.
Arseface was good overall, but that was a minor thing that hurt me. I had some issues, not as many as you, as we'll get to in just a second, because I know what your biggest problem with the episode was. I was not crazy about the state of Tulip, because, and I know you're going to get into her in just a second here, but the Tulip in the comics, when she starts out, is very much a novice. She is in a bad place,
She has clearly committed crimes in the past, but she is not a hardened criminal by any stretch
of the imagination.
Well, and
for me it's less the hardened criminal thing than it is the again, we're in spoiler territory, but the ability to fashion a homemade rocket launcher and shoot a helicopter out of the sky. When you do that in the first episode, where do you go from there? Part of the joy of Tulip in the comics is watching as she grows over the course of the series into this just ridiculous badass character. But you know, that's the choice they went with, and it ultimately didn't bother me that much. I really liked the scene with her and the kids in the house. I thought that was a cute little scene, and the kids were really funny in that scene. But you know, it was not exactly what I would love to see out of Tulip. And I know that we're in the vast minority. Most people are really praising the Tulip from last night, but it didn't strike the chords for me that I was hoping would. I also don't like the idea of her being a negative influence on Jesse in terms of kind of taking him away from whatever semblance of happiness he may have.
She is essentially trying to directly stand in his way of improving his life, which is not, that's my biggest issue with it. If you named that character anything else, just made up a name and didn't call her Tulip, I'm fine with her, but you called her Tulip. So for people who have read the book, that's what I have in mind. And to me, that's something that Tulip would never do. She would never, like, actively try to prevent Jesse from finding happiness, or actively try to prevent Jesse from improving his life, or threaten Jesse and his church if he doesn't agree to go along with whatever criminal scheme she's got, you know, cooked up.
Right.
There were just so many moments in that pilot from her. Like, honestly, outside of the scene at the table with the kids, every other Tulip moment in that episode did not feel like Tulip in any way, shape, or form to me. The performance was fine, outside of the accent like we discussed, but, you know, it just, that's the one character I have the most concern about right now, because what we were told in interviews is that they're reshaping the opening of the story in an effort to get you to see how these characters come to be. Because in the comic, Jesse is imbued with the power of Genesis and blows up his entire congregation and burns down the town of Anvil within, what, 12 pages, 12, 16, 18 pages, somewhere in that vicinity. This is a slow burn. This is the story of how we get to there, in theory anyway. The problem with that is, if you're going to tell the stories of how these characters come to be fully formed, you can't start with them, one of them already fully formed, as the version of the character that she becomes at the end of the book. And that's my biggest issue with her in this, is it. She is akin to a version of Tulip I am willing to accept down the road. I'm not willing to accept that right now. And also, what exactly is the status of her and Jesse's relationship? In the book, you know, the events that happen in Anvil are the first time she's seen Jesse in years. In this pilot, we get the impression, or I got the impression anyway, that they had at least been in contact somewhat, and there had not been that long gap of time between them seeing each other.
I kind of viewed it differently. I viewed it as there had been a significant gap, because she clearly hadn't spoken to Jesse since he became a preacher, since he moved back to Anvil. And I get the impression that that had to have happened some distance of time ago, enough for him to learn who these residents are, learn their problems, and develop a weird quasi-relationship with this other woman. So I don't know. I think that they clearly knew each other in the past and had a relationship of some kind, and it's been a while, I think. I don't get the impression that Jesse just stopped being a criminal and then, you know, a month later he's in the pilot, you know. So I think for me it was not, that wasn't an issue, but I agree with you. A lot of your Tulip complaints are on point, I think.
Yeah, and speaking of that other lady that I don't remember the name of, that's one thing you mentioned, is that a lot of these characters that we're supposed to be getting to know in his congregation are kind of forgettable.
Yeah.
That lady might as well have just hung a giant neon sign in front of her vagina that said, "Please enter here," because she was putting all her feminine charm in the efforts to bed Jesse, and he was having none of it in this pilot.
Yeah, and I think that's because this Jesse that we meet is trying his best to try to live a holy life, even though he still drinks and fights and all that stuff. He's trying not to, and I think that's part of the reasoning behind that. But it's, I mean, we'll see where they're going with it. I'm definitely going to give them a chance to tell their story. I like the pilot overall, and I think there's enough good there that it's going to be, if nothing else, it'll be worth it for the comedy. Even if they don't get the relationship dynamics as perfect as we want, at least it's going to be funny.
And one thing that kind of gives me some hope is apparently they shot this pilot as a pilot. And what I mean when I say that is they shot this not knowing if they were going to get ordered to a full series. Then they got ordered 6 months later. So they shot this by itself, then came back 6 months later and shot the other 9 episodes back to back. So they were able to probably, I'm hoping and guessing, refine some of the things from the pilot they didn't like. And also, now they know they've got time to tell a story. And they know they've got time to plant seeds for things that are going to be paid off down the road. And don't have to worry so much with just kind of having a pilot to present as a standalone entity. So, I'm, again, far more good than bad. I think the best way I can sum it up is, the things that were good were things I liked. The things that I didn't like were things I hated, for the most part. But at the end of the day, I'd say, you know, solid B-, B to a B- in there. And I'm interested to see where it goes from here. And I am certainly going to give them, I'm going to give them this season to before I, you know, even consider writing off the show, which I'm nowhere near at this point. I don't want to make it sound like that.
Yeah, I liked it too.
It's oftentimes easier to discuss negativity than it is positivity. And, you know, we fall into that trap, but overall, I really like the episode a good
bit. I would give it a B. Yeah, I'd give it a solid B, and with plenty of room to improve, but much better than I thought it would be, to be honest with you. I had severe reservations as recently as a month ago, and I was impressed. So we'll see where it goes from there.
I'm sure we'll discuss it more as the season goes on because, you know, Flash and Arrow are both coming up on season finale, so it'll be pretty much the only comic book show running besides Fear the Walking Dead, which I'm hopelessly behind on. So
I'm behind on it now too, actually. I have all the episodes recorded. I just have to carve out time to go back and watch them. Same with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I just have to carve out the time to go in and watch them. But Preacher and Fear the Walking Dead will be it over the summer. I mean, actually, well, the new Robert Kirkman show, Outcast, just started, but I can't watch it because you have to have, what is it, Cinemax to watch it? So
I couldn't tell you. That one's kind of off my radar, to be honest. So,
but yeah, so anyway, that wraps up our reading and watching segment. We talked a long time because that's just how passionate we are about Preacher. For both of us, it's one of our favorite comics of all time. So hopefully you guys out there in Podcastville liked it. Maybe you didn't. Let us know what you thought about it. We're interested in hearing your thoughts about the pilot. Go to the Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics, and let's start some discussion on it, guys. And we hope that you stick with us through this break, because when we come back, we're going to get to the actual countdown finally, where we'll tell you our favorite Preacher characters.
And when we come back from the break, leave your inhibitions at the door, because we're getting, again, we're venturing into very, very not safe for work territory. So prepare yourself for that. Prepare yourself for lots of bestiality, meat fetishes, and just every disgusting, dirty form of sexual deviancy and borderline.
Marquis de Sade ain't got nothing on us.
Ain't got nothing on us. And borderline blasphemy as well. So that's coming on the other side of the break. So
just giving you a warning, folks. So anyway, stick with us after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tourneaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gather around and started talking, Dustin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard, we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.
And here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, it's finally time. Children, too, if any children are out there listening, which I wouldn't recommend right now.
No, we might get a little vulgar with this one. So
we are counting down our top five preacher characters that do not count the main character, Jesse Custer. As we've mentioned earlier, Preacher is one of our favorite comic book series of all time.
Absolutely.
Started in the 90s, carried on through the end of that decade, had a wonderful run, Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. And through the years, we met a ton of great characters in this book. Characters that had depth, characters that provided much emotion and a connection with the reading audience. And then you just had characters that were, for lack of a better term, completely insane. Just the funniest, most over-the-top caricatures imaginable, and they were wonderful.
Yes.
And so you're going to see a hodgepodge of characters on our list, some that perhaps have some more emotional depth than others, and some that are here simply for the fact that they made us laugh our collective asses off. So get ready for that.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. My appreciation of Preacher tends to skew a little bit more to the absurd. So, with that in mind, I'll kick our list off with a very absurd character, in my opinion. I'm going to go at number five with the character of TC. And TC, if you've not read the book, is he's essentially the talker, the backup to Jody's muscle. And Jody, of course, is the enforcer for Jesse's grandmother in the series. But TC is primarily, you know, known for his, shall we say, penchant for bestiality. And that's his primary character motivation in the book, is just finding a way to put his genitalia in or around various animals. And it's played for laughs, for the most part, including a...
As you would imagine.
As you would do, including a scene, a couple of scenes, one where he talks about gutting a fish and using it as a, you know, sex toy of some kind. And then also his penchant for bestiality also plays a, a major role in the book in explaining Jesse's backstory, because one of the things they do with Jesse's backstory is they give him a an inbred friend from down the way, Billy Bob. And Billy Bob meets an untimely demise when he unfortunately witnesses TC bugger in a chicken. And things I never thought I'd talk about in public in my life. But so that's TC. He's played for laughs and he's pretty funny. I can't really say much more without getting into graphic detail that I don't know I want to go into, but you know, inbred redneck guy that he likes animals of all shapes, sizes, and you know, species
and openings.
Yeah, that too. Even if he has to create his own.
Yeah, that may have been my favorite individual arc within Preacher. Was the time that we were introduced to Jesse's grandmother and Jody and TC and that whole gang, which included we can't forget the inbred family with the two one-eyed people that were married to each other.
The brother and sister were going to marry each other.
They're going to marry each other, yes, engaged.
But sadly, poor Billy Bob was struck down before he could marry his sister.
That's right. And she went on to move to the same town that Jesse's mom lives in.
Spoilers.
And she sees humans as different things because of her unique condition. So occasionally a human talking to her will look like a unicorn or a horse or something. So, but yes, no, TC was one of a litany of just ridiculous characters. And I'm glad that we started out our list with him, because that's a great barometer, I think, for whether you will enjoy Preacher or not. If you find the concept that Nick just laid out of TC to be humorous in any way, you're probably going to love Preacher. If you did not get it and don't think it's funny at all,
or find it disgusting and reprehensible,
don't read Preacher, because that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh my God.
Preacher gets a lot more disgusting and a lot more offensive than that. So.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have him on your list, but if we were sitting here discussing Jesus the Sod, I think we'd have an even worse version of that conversation.
Yes, potentially so. Well, with that said, I suppose I will move on to my number five, which is a little gentleman who's introduced very late into the series, but stole my heart nonetheless. And he's a little fellow by the name of Odin Quincannon. He is, to try to give you a visual image of what Odin Quincannon looks like, and feel free to Google him while I'm telling you this, he is essentially a Ross Perot stand-in. Would you agree, Nick?
Yes, but almost like, not really Ross Perot, but more like whatever the SNL version of Ross Perot probably would have been at the time. Like
Dana Carvey's Ross Perot?
Dana Carvey's Ross Perot, yes.
Go get on a bench.
Yeah, essentially, yes.
Anyway, so Mr. Quincannon encounters our band of merry characters late in the series, and he runs a meat processing plant. in a Texas town, of course. And as you might imagine, as with most of the characters involved in Preacher, he has some rather interesting sexual quirks.
Indeed.
To say the least. You see, he runs a sausage making plant, and he oftentimes goes into the sausage factory, orders his workers to close the door, and all you can see are text bubbles of worth expressions such as stroke the balls and cradle the shaft, or cradle the balls and stroke the shaft, which is pretty. That's about as explicit as I'll get on this podcast. But it's a ridiculous individual. He's also a member of the KKK. He's a completely unlikable, just turd of a human being.
He's the kind of guy you love to hate, though, like, because he is endlessly entertaining. Is the thing?
Oh, absolutely. He is. All the villains in Preacher are some of my favorite parts, because they're all reprehensible human beings, but they're also all really entertaining. And so he's just irredeemably bad, but he has these ridiculous kinks. He talks in Ross Perot-isms, just like a million miles a minute with analogies that don't really fit the situation around him. Just phenomenal. He also, and again, we're getting into spoiler territory. He keeps a giant woman-shaped mannequin
that is made of the various trimmings from his sausage plant. And Greg's aforementioned scenario where Mr. Quinn Cannon goes into his sausage plant and they shut the door and you hear, you know, these or see these strange sounds coming out. It's revealed eventually that he is having carnal relations with this giant meat mannequin.
Yes. And again, we have started out our countdown with two of the more extreme characters in Preacher, but again, it gets even more extreme. So if you're not turned off by now, please keep listening. But Odin Quinn Cannon is a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah, Odin's great.
And if they ever do a live action version, I need Dana Carvey to play him because only his Ross Perot fits the voice that I have in my head for Odin Quinn Cannon. Can I finish?
Go right ahead.
No. I was just quoting.
Ah. An underrated character that people forget about is actually his brother, Conan Quinn Cannon, if you remember him.
I vaguely remember Conan.
Well, he was in shit. He was in the shit business, Greg. he trafficked in manure. And if you remember, he gave a certain character a job shoveling manure. Gave that guy a break, and that character happens to be my number four selection. And I think you're going to be a little surprised this guy's so far down on my list, but I got Arseface at number four.
Oh, wow. Our first upset. You have the leader in the clubhouse, so to speak, the odds-on favorite. You have him down at number four. Wow, interesting. But tell the folks out there a little bit about Mr. Arseface.
So Arseface, the concept of Arseface is he was a kid who grew up very much into the grunge music movement of the early 1990s and was very deeply personally affected whenever Kurt Cobain died. And he decided to deal with that by trying to recreate Kurt Cobain's suicide. But due to an unfortunate turn of events and a tragic mishap with a shotgun to the mouth, he didn't actually kill himself. He just wound up, you know, being badly injured, and they had to reconstruct his face, but not quite the best plastic surgery back then. And his face winds up resembling, for a lack of a better term, an arse.
In fact, the character of Cassidy remarks upon first seeing him, "Jesus, your face looks like an arse."
That was a wonderful Cassidy. You should be playing Cassidy in the movie, in the show. Excuse me.
Thank you. I also could be playing Sheamus in WWE right now. So,
and let's not forget the fact that Arseface had a friend named Pube, which is always a good thing to remember.
Yeah, well, and also don't forget that Mike's friend on Growing Pains was named Boner.
Ah, yes, Pube and Boner, the best of the teenage sidekick characters. But so Arseface is kind of this character who at first you think is going to be a throwaway guy that's just in the first volume that you think they're going to play for laughs. And somehow he winds up becoming one of the most pivotal characters in the entire book because he keeps popping up in different places and finding himself. He's almost like the Forrest Gump of this book, if that makes any sense. Like the guy who keeps getting himself into situations he has no business being in. Like mm-hmm. At one point he becomes a world-famous rock star, even despite the fact he can't hardly speak, let alone sing. So that makes it interesting. And then, of course, one of my favorite things is his relationship with his father, who is a miserable, miserable human being who has no love whatsoever for his son, essentially. Sheriff Hugo Root, that is. And
yes, Sheriff Root may not make either of our lists, but he has he was in consideration just because he's a reprehensible human being. But also, it's almost funny all the bad things that happened to him.
Yes.
He's like the ultimate representation of karma. He and another character that I suspect may show up on both of our lists are the living representatives of karma.
Yes, but, you know, Arseface becomes a world-famous rock star, complete with a Colonel Parker ripoff as his manager that's clearly taking advantage of him. But eventually everything winds up well, and Arseface finds love in the aforementioned one-eyed girl that Greg was talking about earlier. So everything ends well for our boy Arseface, but Arseface is almost like the prime example of a great preacher character in that when you describe it out loud, it sounds like the stupidest, like least entertaining thing you've ever heard of, and then in execution, it winds up being hilarious, thought-provoking, and honestly, surprisingly enough, almost a little, like, emotionally touching at times.
Yes, absolutely. Like, honestly, by the end of the book, I think that Arseface is one of the most relatable characters that there is. Like, he's so... You really genuinely root for him to succeed in the book. Like, other than the main characters, you really want him to succeed, and you want him to end up, you know, doing well for himself, because his character undergoes a lot of changes as the book grows, but he's also presented as in this world of cynicism and, you know, edgy characters. Arseface really is presented as a naive, kind of almost an innocent caught up in all this craziness.
Right. Yeah. I completely agree with that. And it's so great to see that innocence, you know, even despite all the bad things that have happened to him, the way his father treats him, he never loses that innocence and never becomes cynical. And in the end, you know, things probably work out better for him than any other character in the book.
Yeah.
He's left in a great place, and it's a cool journey to see him go from complete joke to, you know, to a really beloved character. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the show handles him if it gets multiple seasons.
Yeah, definitely. And at my number four, I have another character who is perhaps naive, but perhaps naive is a light term to use for him. Perhaps, shall we say, challenged would be a better word to use for him. And he is a character, a very controversial character, known as the Messiah.
Now, I want to – okay, so I've had to explain the concept of TC and Arseface. I can't wait to hear you explain the concept of the Messiah. So I'm gonna hang up and listen.
Well – let me preface this by giving my standard warning about Preacher. Preacher, shall we say, could be considered sacrilegious if you are a person of a religious bent. I do consider myself, you know, I'm not going to get too deep into all that stuff, but I do consider myself somewhat religious, but I've always enjoyed things like Preacher and like Kevin Smith's Dogma movie. Because, you know, I find the humor in the way they poke fun at the people rather than necessarily the religion. Well, this is more of a I would say one of the more sacrilegious concepts in the book, but it's also one of the funniest. In the context of the Preacher universe, the Messiah is the last descendant of Jesus in that according to the Preacher universe, Jesus had a family with Mary Magdalene, and over the years, certain individuals took control of this, kept these people sequestered, and made sure that they this bloodline of Jesus basically continued passing on from generation to generation, inbreeding after inbreeding.
2,000 years of inbreeding.
Yes. And so in the end, the result is this character called the Messiah. And this group called the Grail builds itself on the idea that the apocalypse is coming and that this Messiah character will be the leader of the world. Well, there's a problem with that. As a result of the 2,000 years of inbreeding, the Messiah is capable only of shouting the word Humperty-doo to the top of his lungs, and flinging his own feces at anyone nearby. So he basically is kept in a cage and perpetually hurls fecal matter at the wall while shouting, or sometimes even whispering, Humperty-doo, and jumping in the air a la The Breakfast Club. And for that reason, he makes my list, because damn, if Humperty-Doo isn't something that is still in my lexicon to this day, even 5 or 6 years after I first read Preacher, and it's still an in-joke among some of my friends, just shouting out, Humperty-Doo!
And if it doesn't sound sacrilegious enough as it is, they also revealed at one point that the only reason they were able to successfully inbreed for literally 2,000 years was because the magical blood of Jesus allowed it. So Jesus allowed this inbreeding, if you want to look at it that way.
You're not helping my case to the religious audience, Nick.
I'm going to assume that most of the religious audience checked out at TC Bugger and Animals in the first part of this, so...
Well, again, you have to... There are exceptions, like myself and Todd Weber, who can enjoy the book despite our beliefs. So,
right.
No, it's very good. It's very entertaining. Now, let's hear your number four and see if we can get... Let's see if we can get any worse than the Messiah.
Well, that was... I've already done my number four, if you remember. Arseface.
Oh, that's right.
Four.
Three. I'm sorry.
So we're going to number three, and I've got, in another probably mild upset, considering that you'll probably have him higher, I'm going Air Star at number three.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm gonna refrain from comment because he's a little bit higher up on my list.
I figured he was. And I'm gonna keep my thoughts kind of brief because hearing you talk about Air Star, honestly, is one of my favorite topics to get you going on. So I'll let you take the brunt of it. But the basic concept of Air Star is he's a villain who is pursuing our heroes throughout the course of this entire, what is it, a 66-issue story? Is that what it wound up being, Greg? Something like that?
Something along those lines, yeah. I think if you count the one-shots, it's like 70 maybe. But.
And basically, so if you remember that old Dave Chappelle sketch, The Player Haters Ball, where at one point the line was uttered, I hope all the bad things in life happen to you and nobody else but you. Imagine if that actually happened to a human being, and that would be Hair Star, who is introduced as a threatening, you know, badass German soldier for hire, essentially. And over the course of the book, he's humiliated, sexually violated, and, I mean, just about, you know, emasculated in every way a man can be over the course of 60 issues. And damn it if you don't just want to see more of it, the more it happens. So... That's what I'm going to say about Air Star. I'll cut it off there because I know you love talking about that guy. But one of the most hilarious parts of the book, honestly, was seeing Hair Star and his understated reaction to all the bad things that were happening to him and how he tried to cope and stuff. So, fantastic villain that just brings a whole other level of humor to the book.
Oh yeah, no, he's great. And I've got more to say on him, so I'll move on to my number three, who is a character that is dear to a lot of people that love Preacher, and that is the lead female character in the series, which is Tulip O'Hare. She is the love interest of our lead character, Jesse Custer. I would argue she's probably the number two central point character, maybe number three if you count Hair Star as number two, in terms of the character that gets the most focus in the book. She has... a tragic backstory, as a lot of these characters do. She had a rough upbringing, learned a lot from her dad, and became an expert marksman. But over the course of these 60-plus issues of Preacher, she also goes through a huge character arc of peaks and valleys changing from the beginning to the end, the same way that Jesse Custer does, the same way that Hair Star does, the same way that Arseface does. She goes through this incredible character arc where we really see her put through the ringer and go through the worst things that can happen and come out the other side and be the guiding light that puts Jesse kind of in his place when he needs to be put in his place. She keeps him going. She motivates him, but she also makes sure to put him in line when he's starting to veer off the course. And at the end of the story, Tulip is another one of these characters. There aren't a lot of characters in Preacher that you really want good things to happen to. She's one of them. And I think that the way that Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon portrayed her backstory was one of my favorite diversions throughout Preacher. I loved her backstory. I loved her origin. Seeing her and the tragic loss of her father. One of the most heartbreaking moments to me in the whole book, because it just happened. Preacher is great about giving you these shock deaths that, to me, work better than the shock deaths that I've read in the Walking Dead book, because these shock deaths happen and you really get the fallout of it.
Right.
And I remember the panel where Tulip sees her dad's smoking skull, basically, and it's just – it's heartbreaking. And – she grows up and you get to see why she makes the decisions that she makes. Because there are times that she makes decisions that you're like, what is she doing? What is she thinking? But it's because of this backstory, and you see the changes that are made in her by the end when you see the effects that what Jesse's gone through has on her. So,
right. And you talk about shock deaths. She even is involved directly in a pretty shocking death fairly early in the book that I didn't see coming. Mm-hmm. And it, I remember that being one of my biggest jaw-dropping moments, talking specifically, you know, about the scene with her at mm-hmm. Jesse's grandmother's house. So, mm-hmm. you know, that that was great. She's a great character. I don't have her on my list because there are just so many, but she, you definitely feel for her, and it's one of those romantic stories you're very much invested in by fairly early on in the book, honestly, because the dynamic between her and Jesse works so well that you really want to see those two characters get a happy ending. So it was
absolutely. And it also, she also helps illustrate the great dichotomy of Preacher, which is on the one hand, this absurdist parody of modern society at the time, modern society. And then on the other hand, this really emotional love story that you're seeing played out within the confines of this absurd, over the top, satire, basically, of our culture. And it's like, it's so weird that you can have such an emotional connection to these characters who are surrounded by people with asses for faces and people with predilections for having sex with animals and stuff like that.
And sausage.
And in the midst of all of this, and this supernatural element, you have this love story that keeps the whole thing grounded and that keeps you invested from chapter to chapter. Really brilliant storytelling.
Yeah, I agree. But you mentioned the supernatural element, and that segues pretty well into my number two selection. I'm going to go with the Saint of Killers at number two.
Nice.
Just a wonderful character that I think almost gets overlooked in a weird way when you talk about Preacher, because you wind up talking so much about the satirical elements and the comedy. But this is a character who is played absolutely 100% straight in the book. And any humor involving him is not over the top. It's not played for laughs, essentially. It's very dry humor. But this is a character who's essentially kind of like it's kind of the Unforgiven story, you know, of a man who loses his family in the Old West and goes on a mission of vengeance. The twist is he doesn't fulfill his mission. He's actually killed by the leader of the gang that he holds responsible for murdering for killing his wife and child. And he goes to hell and is reborn as the Saint of Killers. And I hate reading from Wikipedia, but this is too badass not to read. His own hatred and indignation over the injustice of his death and that of his family causes hell to literally freeze over, much to the devil's wrath, which causes the angel of death to offer him to return to earth under the condition that he takes up his role of collecting the souls of those who die by violence. Melting the angel of death's sword in hell's last burning fire, the devil forges two Walker Colt revolvers that will kill anything, never miss their target, never leave his possession, and never run out of bullets. He is now dubbed the Saint of Killers, but the devil makes the mistake of insulting the saint as he returns to earth, prompting the angry saint to gun the devil down as his first victim, leaving the fate of hell unknown. If that doesn't sell you on that, the concept of that character, I don't know what you're doing here. I mean, that is an awesome backstory for a character, and they play him like essentially the biggest badass that ever walked the face of the planet.
Pretty much when he shows up, somebody and or everybody is going to die.
It is the nuclear option. There is no good way for the saint there's no good outcome when he shows up.
Don't read him as like grizzled Clint Eastwood, I don't know what's wrong with you, because every time he shows up he goes, "Preacher." That's all I can hear in my head is the grizzled, you know, smoker's voice of Clint Eastwood just ready to gun down anyone in his path.
The next time they finally do a Marvel versus DC crossover, I want Old Man Logan versus the Saint of Killers. That's my ultimate, like, Old West story, and see what happens. It'd be awesome. But no, he's a fantastic character that actually winds up getting a new motivation partway through the series that's really interesting. And honestly, you could say he probably has the book's most important climactic moment. And a moment that, again, a lot of people would consider sacrilegious, but I don't want to get into all that here. So, I know you're a big fan, being a fan of Westerns. I'm surprised I haven't heard about him on your list yet.
Yeah, no, it's surprising he didn't make my list.
Oh, man.
But I love the character. I mean, he's great. He's outstanding. But like you said this at the outset, there was a list of 10 to 15 characters that I considered putting on here, and he was on that list, but ultimately missed out because I had to get this guy on the list. At number two on my list, I've got a man already mentioned, he who has the head that resembles the penis, Harris Starr. Now, as Nick mentioned, in my readings of Preacher, very few, if any, characters gave me more consistent joy to read than Harris Starr, because it's amazing to see one character put through literally the worst things that could ever happen to anyone. As Nick pointed out earlier, it's the player hater's ball on crack, basically, on speed. Everything that you could imagine. This guy, he comes in, he's supposed to be the big bad guy, and at first I thought, okay, this is the serious bad guy. First of all, there are at least eight different times during Preacher where it looks like Harris Starr is dead and should be dead, and he somehow survives. So and he views it as good luck. He thinks he's immortal because at one point he actually says he must be immortal. That's the only explanation for how he keeps surviving these things. But he only survives to get even worse things happening to him than happened before. And what is his response each time a bad thing happens to him? Well, I'll tell you, it's very simple. He simply sighs and goes, ah, shit. Or sometimes, and my favorite one, when the Messiah throws a pile of the Messiah's own feces right in the face of Harris Starr after Harris Starr has finally met. And keep in mind, Harris Starr throughout the entire first volume of Preacher and the second volume as well is being told of the Messiah and how important the Messiah is. So he's expecting to meet Jesus in the flesh. And instead, the first thing he sees when he sees the Messiah is he hears Humperty Doo and he gets a flinging pile of poo right in his face. And he's hit with the face, and it slides. He's hit the face, and the poop slides down his face, and he goes, "Shit!" it's just the greatest thing. Whenever he says "shit," you just know either something amazing just happened or something amazing is about to happen. He has his genitalia chewed off by dogs. he is sexually violated on at least two occasions by different people. He's kidnapped and tortured with limbs sawed off in the middle of the desert. He's blown up in a helicopter. He's dropped from a helicopter. He's shot I don't know how many times throughout the course of the book.
Don't forget the knife wound to the head.
The knife wound to the head that causes him to look like a penis. it is incredible. And through it all, in addition to his resigned outlook on things and his bizarre optimism about, well, maybe it just means I can't be killed, in between, he takes out all of his frustrations, because he's got so many frustrations in his life. He takes out his frustrations on his poor henchman, his henchwoman, Featherstone, and it's a perpetual string of profanities, often in combinations I had never heard before reading Preacher. The man, like, what's the line in A Christmas Story? He deals with profanity the way that Rembrandt deals
right.
with or whatever.
Oils, yeah,
you know, just that's the number one character I'm worried about translating to television, because you can't have Harris Starr successfully without just a string of ridiculous profanities and of course the oh shit refrain.
And see, I think they might kind of hold him for later to see how the show is doing, to see how what they can get away with is what I'm thinking. Because I haven't seen a casting announcement for him that I can recall anyway.
No, I haven't either.
But he has to be on the show. He's so integral to the plot that you can't do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're talking combinations of, you know, the words you can't say on TV plus human anatomy parts plus nonsense. Just what an amazing character. And wonderful to read from beginning to end.
And then, much like a bunch of other characters on our list, he also has some very strange sexual preferences. including at one point having a sawfish inserted into his rectum.
And when asked why, his response is, just do it.
We have lost probably 95% of our audience over the course of this show, I would imagine.
I don't think there's anybody left. I mean, we probably have Russell and Todd left.
Yeah.
But everybody else has probably abandoned ship at this point.
It's like the third hour numbers for Raw. It's just, that's what's happening right now. Just the fall off the cliff.
Yeah, we started well. We built our audience, and then we lost all of them.
Every single damn one of them.
Hopefully, this isn't our year 2002 where we just hemorrhaged the entire remaining audience that we had from the first several episodes.
Yeah, by proxy, I imagine this will probably have a major effect on the other podcast because people are going to be so disgusted by this, they're going to unsubscribe from the feed altogether. So we apologize to our compatriots for ruining your podcasting lives.
But if you're mad at us, folks, don't take it out on us. Take it out on Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, who created Preacher. You can contact them on Twitter at their various Twitter handles that I'm sure they have. But given that I'm sure they're also listeners to our podcast.
Oh, of course.
I would actually praise them and say, hey, great job, guys.
Yeah, we have lots of famous creators listen to the podcast. I think Peter David being the most notable example. He's a huge fan.
Yes, Peter David is a huge fan of Place to Be Nation. And he's said that from day one. Especially our fantasy draft. He really likes that.
He does. All right, so that's your number two. So I think I know where your number one is. My number one, I am going with the third leg of the main character triumvirate of Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy. I'm going with Cassidy as my number one. Just a wildly entertaining character who has lots of depth. And it's so weird because the character is a vampire. But I would argue he's winds up being one of the most human characters in the entire story. Because he's a man who isn't inherently good or bad. And he does things that he knows are wrong, but he does them anyway, just like we all do. We all do things in life that we know we shouldn't do, and we know are kind of shit moves. But when he does those things, he oftentimes tries to make up for them. And he's got a fascinating backstory that you learn about his interactions with people over the course of history since he became a vampire. And he provides some much-needed intrigue into the Jesse and Tulip romantic interest at one point. He's great, and he has a moment at the end of the book that's almost akin to the Rorschach moment at the end of Watchmen, where he makes the choice to not keep going anymore. And it's actually a really beautiful moment, even though they had, I think, tried to get you to that point towards the end of the book, kind of hate the guy at that point. But he
He had made so many dick moves in those last few chapters of Preacher but they almost came back around to making him, you know, to redeeming him.
Oh, definitely. I would say so. I think they totally redeemed him. And it's great, man. I can't say enough good things about Cassidy. That's one of the things I'm most concerned about with the show is I'm worried that the guy playing him is gonna you know, let me down, because I have tremendously high hopes for that character, because he's really, I mean, at times counted on to be the main driving comedic force, you know, whenever it's just the three main characters on screen.
So. Oh, Jesus.
Jesus. Yeah, you got to have a little bit of that. So if we were doing the big budget, big screen, I would kill for Colin Farrell to play Cassidy. It'd be amazing. With a bad hairpiece and some 90s sunglasses, it'd be a fantastic thing to see. But yeah, he's a character that you see, like we were saying, Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy probably take up more page time. I want to say screen time, but page time than anybody else. And you never tire of him. You're always wanting to see more of him. And yeah, just a great character that I love. Plus, his first name is Proincius. Proincius? How do you pronounce it?
Proincius?
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 Proincius. If you're Irish, just, you know,
drop us a line.
Hit us on Twitter with the phonetic spelling, or the phonetic spelling of Proincius.
I actually do think we've got at least one Irish listener out there, so hit me up on Twitter and let me know the correct pronunciation of that
name.
Yes,
but once you let him know the correct pronunciation of that, if you could, Becky, just, you know, slide into my DMs at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't going to go there, but, you know, if you want to, that's fine by me. But we're tight like that, so she may just do that. So, And now that leaves me with my number one character, who, of course, is the man whose face is an arse, Arseface.
So Greg's top two characters are the man whose head is a dick and the man whose face is an arse. That doesn't...
Make of that what you will.
If that doesn't distill both Preacher and Greg's sexual preferences in the most clear way, I don't know what else will.
Hey, make of it what you will, my friend. It also reminds me of Team America World Police and the explanation of the types of people there are in the world. But anyway, for any of you guys that haven't watched Team America, go watch it. It's really funny. Anyway, yes, Arseface is amazing. My favorite character in the Preacher universe. He has such an amazing arc from beginning to end. We already kind of touched on a lot of the things that make his character unique, his story unique. But in my opinion, he's also just funny. I mean, from beginning to end, he's just hilarious. The style of talking they give him when you read Preacher, I don't know how it's going to translate over the course of an entire season, but in the book, it never stops being funny to me, because at first, they translate it because of the nature of his face, he doesn't really have a true mouth anymore. He talks, and it's like, he'll say things like, "Shutha," and then it'll have a little star, and then in italics, it'll do the translator. Everybody that's read superhero comics is familiar with the translation bubble, and they'll do the translation bubble, and it'll say, "Sure thing." So, "Shutha" is "sure thing," and he'll be like, and that'll be, "Well, could be." And it's...
Or, "I love you, duh," which is, "I love you, Dad."
Yep, exactly. And so, to show you how awesome and how funny this is, my friends and I, in college and just after college, we were just reading Preacher at about the same time. This would be me and you, Nick, and then Sam, our friend Sam as well, and Jeremy as well.
I think Sam was the one who kind of introduced me to Preacher, from what I can recall.
And we, if you recall, we would go, when we were all in the height of reading this, we would have entire conversations in Arseface voice.
Yes.
And you want to talk about funny, is trying to, like, talk over a meal at, I don't know, Applebee's or something, and trying to have a conversation in Arseface voice, and the waitress approaches and hears you talking in Arseface voice. Good times, let me tell you. But no, just phenomenal. Sunday up, blah, blah, blah. I'm looking at an advertisement right now. Sundays are better with brunch, and I'm thinking of how would it sound in Arseface's voice. You know? Hey, let's look at my BB&T statement here. Branch Banking and Trust Company Operations Center. I mean, you can do anything with this. It just never ceases. And in fact, I would like to invite our other Preacher colleague, Todd Weber, who loves the book as much as we do. We need to come on and do a podcast that's about a 30-minute podcast of nothing but Arseface speak. Let's do it. Are you up for it, Nick?
I can give it. I'll give it a shot. Why not?
Why not? Am I serious? I'll leave that to the listeners to decide. But with that being said, I mean, I can't really think of too much else to say about him. We said a lot earlier, but he's a great character in terms of you really do root for him, but he also consistently entertains you. And I can't think of a character in Preacher, and this is such a testament to it. I can't think of a character who lasts a long time in Preacher who I don't find entertaining. Because most of the ones that aren't entertaining are killed off pretty quickly or disappear pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's true. He's one of the ones that keeps – one of the few that maintains a presence from pretty much the beginning till the end. And It's a testament to his strength as a character that you never tire of him. So,
absolutely. Well, that about brings our countdown to the end. Let's recap our lists for the five or six people who are still listening to us. My number five was Odin Quincannon. My number four was the Messiah. My number three was Tulip.
Hold on. Let's start that over.
My number five was Odin Quincannon.
The meat fucker.
My number four was the Messiah.
The shit thrower.
My number three was Tulip O'Hare.
I got nothing.
Number two was...
Wait. Oh. The blood pisser.
Number two is Hair Star.
The dickhead.
Number one is Arseface.
That one just writes itself.
And what was your list, sir?
Mine, just to recap, was at number five, I had TC.
The Fish Screwer.
The Fish Screwer, yeah. At number four, I had Arseface, who we mentioned just a moment ago. At number three, I had Airstar. At number
The Dickhead.
At number two, I had the Saint of Killers.
The Mean Guy.
The Mean Guy, yeah, that's the best one. And, of course, at number one, I had Cassidy.
The Irish Guy.
The Irish Guy that vampires and drinks blood and whatnot.
That's right. He likes Seamus. He's a big fan.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? Are you listening out there, fella? We love you. In our own way.
Love you, Bobby.
Do we love Bobby?
Yes.
Oh, man. Good times. Well, that brings another edition of Countdown to an end, folks. We're a little over a month now, I guess, into the hard-traveling fanboys
episode podcast. 5. As I discussed, we got to be getting ready for a new number one at some point.
That's right. We hope that you've been enjoying it to this point. We've had a good time with it. You know, there's been some hiccups along the way, but we're figuring out our proper layout and everything, and we're getting it where we want it to be. But we hope you've been enjoying us so far. And what do we got coming for the people next week?
So next week, if I'm recalling correctly, is we're going to go off the page once more, and we're going to look at X-Men, the original X-Men from 2000, in honor of the release of X-Men Apocalypse that's rapidly approaching. So
it's
going to be interesting because I think you and I both like the movie, but I think our appreciation for it varies a little bit. I think so. We'll have some interesting discussion there, and just to see how it holds up in a post Days of Future Past world, which in my opinion. I know you disagree with this as well, but it's kind of the high water mark for the X franchise as far as I'm concerned.
It'll also be interesting because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we'll both have seen X-Men Apocalypse by the time we record this next podcast.
Probably not, actually. But
oh, okay.
Yeah. One thing we will be talking about, though, so next week is off the page, but be sure because next week, by this point, we will have read, both of us, we'll have read and have, I'm sure, plenty of thoughts on not just the finale of Darkseid War in Justice League. Justice League 50 comes out. We're also going to have read DC Universe Rebirth written by Geoff Johns, which is already drawing in advanced reviews, perfect scores from comics websites across the internet. And on that note, if you haven't read that book by the time you listen to this podcast, be careful because spoilers are afloat. Big time. Massive spoilers out there. I already had one plot point for me spoiled for me. Luckily, not the major points, but a certain character who makes a return that I was not expecting. So I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time talking about that next week because you and I think, are in agreement that we are more excited for that single issue than we've probably been any single issue of anything in a long time.
Yeah, maybe since Green Lantern number 20.
Yeah, that's kind of weird because people are giving it perfect scores, so now the expectations already have been artificially, you know, inflated. So now I'm essentially expecting it to be as good as Green Lantern 20, which is a high, high bar for any single issue to meet.
But, absolutely. But you know, what? With the level of talent that got involved, and if this is truly Geoff Johns' swan song
for now,
for a while, then you know it's going to be a big moment because he's been our favorite writer for years now. So. If it's true that he's taken time off to do movies and TV shows and stuff like that, then this is a pretty big moment for not just DC fans, but I think comic fans in general. So definitely going to be paying attention to that. But anyway, we'll hit you next week with that episode on X-Men from 2000, and then here for the next countdown next month, we're going to have Glenn Butler. Will be stopping by to help us count down the best comic book related film scores
and theme songs. We're also going to count theme songs as in this
right.
as well. So
theme songs. Yeah. So that it should be a fun little countdown. If you don't know, Glenn is an expert on all things film score. He's an encyclopedia of this kind of stuff. So we're looking forward to having him on the show.
Yes. It's going to be great to have Glenn on because he knows a lot about music composition and he'll have some great selections that are fantastic pieces of classical music that nobody else would imagine, and I'll have tons of cheesy cartoon songs like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme. So
that's right.
Great dichotomy there.
He'll also raise the intellect level on this podcast by about 100 IQ points. So
well, you can't really evaluate how high he'll raise it because you can't multiply by zero, as you know. So
that's true. We're
wildly different podcast that will be. We're going to go from talking about fish fucking to talking about film scores. So that's interesting.
Yep. And we'll get our Masterpiece Theater music ready to introduce us. So,
oh, yes, that'll be great. Actually, so, you know, you heard our list today. If you have a list, if you want to talk about, you know, your five favorite Preacher characters, be sure to hit us up on the Twitter machine, at NickDuke87 and at GPhillips8652. We also have the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. And then we've actually got something new in the works that I'm not sure will be ready by the time this podcast drops, but keep your eyes and ears peeled to Place to Be Nation. We got a very exciting development, especially as it concerns this podcast coming up, that I think Greg and I both are pretty pumped about. So
absolutely, it's gonna kind of open us up to new avenues and maybe get some more people on board the old PTBN Express. But I did want to say that on our Facebook page, we've had some good discussion recently in recent weeks. The activity there is starting to raise people talking about, you know, favorite, least favorite things, talking about new comics. Shout out to some of the people that have been posting there. Greg Bowen, for instance, posts there. We've had Damon Hawk posting there. We've had a lot of people in there. Jennifer Smith started posting in there. So
she's going to guest on one, correct?
And she's going to be guesting on our next Long Book Hunters, which we will be reviewing Green Lantern Rebirth. I actually just today, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, opened up my absolute Green Lantern Rebirth edition, and so I'm already getting cracking on that. So,
and since you mentioned the next Long Book Hunters, I guess we should already mention in 2 weeks' time we'll have the next Rundown. And I don't know if you've been keeping up with comics news at all over the last few weeks. This is going to be a jam-packed edition of the Rundown. It's like big news after big news has been dropping over the last few weeks, and so looking forward to that and whatever else might drop in between now and then, because we got a lot of things to discuss. It might wind up being like the Peter Jackson version of a podcast, where it just goes and goes with like eight false endings.
The last month of comic book news has been the equivalent of the month preceding WrestleMania for wrestling news.
Right. It almost makes you wonder how the news cycle for Comic-Con this year is possibly going to live up to what's been going on here, you know, the last few weeks. But
yeah,
we'll get in depth in that in 2 weeks. So, but in the meantime, be back next week as we take that look at X-Men 2000 and hit you up with our thoughts on DC Universe Rebirth. And until next time, guys, it's been fun, and you know, have a good day.
Shut up.
Though he tried and tried and tried. And the halls of his memory still echo her lies. And he cried like a baby, and he screamed like a panther in the middle of the night. And he saddled his pony, and he went for a ride. It was the time of the preacher in the year of 01. Now the lesson is over and the killing's begun.